This is a win for the Australian people.
We are fighting the fake news. It's fake, phony.
I'm a bit lost for words. That doesn't happen very often.
Do not expect politicians to be talking about each other.
The rap.
So you get to the end of the week and you think back at the week's news and 5 days, so much has happened. It's time now to take a moment to stop, a little reflection. Never hurts anyone. Ange Lavoie-Pierre is the host of the ABC's daily news podcast, The Signal. It's great. If you're not subscribing, you should be. Also The Party Room, also RN Drive. Okay, I've plugged enough. Hello, welcome.
Hi, thanks, PK.
I just had to get them into it. Okay. John Ferguson is an associate editor at The Australian. Hello, John.
Hi, PK.
And they're both here to share. Let's start with your story, John. You've been keeping a keen eye on Bill Shorten this week. Why? What's he been up to?
I'm a bit fascinated at the moment. I believe that there's a really strong cost of living. Well, we know that. The cost of living is everything out there. But I'm intrigued that Malcolm Turnbull doesn't really drill down into the bread, butter of what it costs to live and what people are actually going through out there. And I watched the 7:30 interview with Bill Shorten on Monday night, and I looked at it very closely and I listened, and I think hidden within the detail of that interview are some very, very interesting messages. And I think Bill Shorten is very much on messages, on message. He's talking schools, wages, waiting lists, lower taxes. I'm not saying he's going to achieve all this. Women getting an equal go, having a go at the big end of town. I think his language is pitched perfectly to the cost of living voter.
Let's hear him from that interview and you make your own mind up. Here he is.
What I want to be is a government which looks after working and middle-class families in this country. The benchmarks I'm interested in keeping are our schools properly funded? Are we reducing the waiting lists in hospitals? Are they getting the support they need? I have a vision for this country, but it doesn't involve giving $65 billion to the top end of town and looking after the very wealthy and not the less powerful.
So Malcolm Turnbull is attempting to make a cost of living pitch too, though, like, you know, if we're going to boil it down, particularly on energy prices, the idea of paying these really ridiculously high energy bills, which, let's be honest, do all of our heads in. Well, my house is really hard to air condition and heat. Like, it costs a lot of money when you've got a family. But it's not cutting through?
I don't think it is. I think that the Prime Minister, you make the point that he's trying, but I just don't think he's talking to the average voter. And I think what Labor has learnt, that basically Labor is going to the outer suburbs. They've given up on the inner suburbs. They're speaking to the outer suburbs and regional Australia. And the way Bill Shorten pitches his rhetoric, to me, is almost perfect. Whereas I think Malcolm Turnbull is just struggling to get that real cost of living rhetoric across. And it's almost not believable with him either. And I'm not saying that as, I know that's a harsh call, but I don't think it is believable. And whereas with Bill Shorten, he spent all this time with the unions, it kind of comes across as real. And I know a lot of listeners won't like that, particularly Liberal voters. They won't like that at all, but that is the way I see it. I just feel that the rhetoric is well pitched, and I think he knows what he's doing. It's straight off the polling. Straight off the polling.
Straight over that, all the focus groups, people are saying these things, right?
Yeah, and that's what they are saying. That's what I'm told they are saying. And it's very much not about Labor's given up on a big section of Australia, the big section of Australia that is doing well. They've given up.
But, and yet they still won Batman.
Well, because Batman's an interesting state. Don't forget, despite all the talk about the tofu curtain, above that tofu curtain.
Tofu's delicious, by the way. Let's not.
Well, I think it's incredibly overrated.
Don't be mean to tofu, but yeah, they talk about that. But you think Batman? Well, it was a Labor seat anyway, right?
Well, correct. Yeah. And I think that the further you go out, you actually there is still Labor heartland there.
Oh yeah, Reservoir. Hello, very familiar with these suburbs. Let me tell you, yeah. I've lived in them. Ange,
you know, I wonder if the reason that he might be struggling to cut through, particularly on the energy thing, is because at the moment, their big promise on that, on their strategy to bring down energy prices, is the National Energy Guarantee. And that's very much dependent on state. We haven't seen the detail. The states are going to have to agree, and there's no guarantee that they will. And so it's probably hard to cut through and say that you're going to bring down energy prices if that's the central plank of your kind of cost of living pitch to the electorate.
A mechanism you're talking about. This is a mechanism, the National Energy Guarantee. It's not very tangible, is it?
No, and people aren't, understandably, because it is pretty dense, people aren't full bottle on that policy area, you know, and why would they be?
Now, let's not forget people. I'm sure people have not forgotten, but, you know, doesn't it feel like a long week? Because it was only like Sunday night, Monday morning, kind of in that middle land where I live. It's my land, that time frame. But where we found out that Malcolm Turnbull lost his 30th news poll, and where many days later we've had a big week on the poly pedal, many, many doorstops with Tony Abbott. So many doorstops, so little time. Malcolm Turnbull hasn't had a great week either, has he?
No, I wouldn't say so. The news poll thing has been definitely given, you know, extra legs, if you can call it that, by Tony Abbott's prevalence all week, as you say, many, many doorstops. But, you know, I'm not sure that people necessarily care in the way that we expect that they might. I think they
you
care.
You agree, John?
Oh, I couldn't agree more.
Yeah.
Like when Tony Abbott's like got Latrobe Valley behind him and he's cycling, people are like, whatever.
No one cares. Look, Graham Richardson had he's generally a very good columnist, but had a line in our paper that everyone in Australia is looking at the 30th news poll. Well, no, they're not. There's probably 0.03% of Australia which is interested in it, and no one else cares. They're worried about the cost of living. They're worried about where they're going to go on their next holiday. You know, just
and if they can afford it.
People do care about the hypocrisy. I think if there's one thing, it's the perception of hypocrisy. That is really what that's what it is about the 30th news poll that people care about.
Yeah, that was tricky for him because he set it up, right? The only
reason
we cared about the 30th news poll
is the perception of hypocrisy, the news poll itself.
And I think Paul Kelly made the point that Malcolm Turnbull's biggest challenge is the manner in which he became Prime Minister. And I think that's right, but I still go back to the cost of living question. People out in the community are doing it harder than they feel they should be. And unless the people who are in power are actually talking about that and you know, Canberra can't resolve a lot of the issues that people are facing, but they've got to talk about it. And if the Prime Minister is not talking about the everyday issues, then I think people feel deserted. I think that's where the electorate is at.
If I can throw young people into the mix here, one really striking thing, I know, God, but one really striking thing that came out of this discussion about news poll for me was our esteemed colleague Shalila Medora over at Hack went out to do some vox pops around this, as they want to do. Hack loves a vox pop.
Yeah, I know where you're going with this. I was stunned. Yes, tell us.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And so she came back with this remarkable result, which was that a staggering proportion of the people she'd spoken to, I think it's 50%, I was trying to find the tweet before I came to the studio, but I couldn't quite get there. 50% did not know who the Prime Minister was.
That doesn't surprise me.
So what does that tell you? You know, of course they're not. You know, that's young people. Sure, that's a very specific little cross section. But that
when
tells
I
you,
read that in her tweet, I had a civics meltdown.
Mm.
Yeah, like you don't. Wow.
Yeah,
it's the Prime Minister.
Yeah.
There's an amazing, this is segueing into the US, but there was an amazing story in the New York Times today talking about the vast numbers of Americans who don't know anything about the Holocaust. That just staggered me. And I feel deeply disturbed about that. And it's the same principle in Australia. It does not surprise me that there's low recognition of our Prime Minister because a lot of people are disengaged.
All right, so if there's low recognition of our Prime Minister, there's got to be low recognition of our opposition leader too, right?
Yeah, that number didn't stick with me, but I would bet money that it is lower than 50% if Turnbull's not being recognised.
So then it'll be about those issues again, right, John Ferguson? It'll be about the fact that your wage has stagnated or gone up very incrementally.
Well, I think the wages thing is massive.
I think that's why people are listening to the trade union movement like they haven't for a long time.
Correct. Mm. And that's why I think Bill Shorten's message is probably a bit stronger than it normally would be. But there are also a lot of other pressures out there that, you know, the way people, the digital disruption thing is stressing people out. Now, no Prime Minister's going to be able to fix that, but maybe we just need to have this, and I hate to use the term, but a national conversation about making people feel a little bit more comfortable. It's the old John Howard thing.
Relaxed and comfortable. All right, we're going to go to your big story now because it's federal politics. I've got a bit obsessed there, Ange. This week, the FBI raided the office of Trump's lawyer, Michael Cohen. It's pretty big news. Can you talk us through why they did that?
Yeah, sure. So I think first thing, we are kind of collectively punch drunk on stories coming out of this White House.
I've got a bit of Trump fatigue, I'll admit it.
I think everyone does, but I know that's kind of, on the one hand, one reason not to talk about this story. On the other hand, I think this story is different. It's really easy to kind of get loose perspective on each individual headline that comes out of this administration, but this one is pretty extraordinary, and I think it does deserve special treatment because, as you say, the FBI raided the office, the home, and the hotel of Michael Cohen, that is Trump's longtime personal lawyer and self-described fix-it guy. Now, what's extraordinary about that and what Trump tweeted about at the time is that, you know, the stuff that was seized is communications that are protected by attorney-client privilege. And he tweeted, attorney-client privilege is dead. And he was furious. He was very upset. Now, it's not dead. It just takes there's a very high threshold that needs to be crossed in order for this kind of thing to be breached. So we have to assume that it has been breached and that threshold has been met, because it wasn't Robert Mueller. In fact, it wasn't Robert Mueller at all that, you know, signed off on this warrant. He did refer the matter onwards, but it was a number of US officials, senior US officials, a judge, some people appointed by Trump himself, who had to be convinced that there was basically probable cause to believe that maybe there was evidence there. How many qualifies do you want in that sentence, by the way? That federal crime may have been committed. So that's why it's extraordinary. It really is. It's hard to stress just how much of a game changer that could be. And it's, you know, obviously we don't know. It's going to be some way down the track. We saw Trump seeking to link it to the Mueller investigation, which at first blush is a bit of a weird move. You know, strategically, you'd think, why would you? Because it doesn't have anything to do with Robert Mueller's investigation into links between, well, Russian interference into the US election, nothing to do with it. So why would you kind of try to drag that back into the headlines? But then, of course, you know, Donald Trump has a pattern of trying to, I guess, say that that's a witch hunt and
yes,
it has no legitimacy.
It sets up the story, doesn't it? Let's hear his response. This is Donald Trump.
So I just heard that they broke into the office of one of my personal attorneys, good man. It's a disgraceful situation. It's a total witch hunt. I've been saying it for a long time.
Yeah, there we go. We
there
heard
it is.
It's a witch hunt.
It's the witch hunt. It's the largest conspiracy Washington's ever seen, so on and so forth. Now, it doesn't have anything to do with Mueller's investigation, but that doesn't mean that it isn't going to have an impact on that investigation. And in fact, we're already seeing that because Mueller's investigation has been going for about a year now. And, you know, by all accounts, it seems like he's probably getting to the pointy end of things and indeed was gearing up to interview the president himself. Now, those talks to negotiate that interview, you know, the length, the scope, all of those kinds of things have been in train for months. Now, as a result of the FBI raids, which Trump, you know, for whatever reason, has, you know, pinned on Mueller in his mind, at least, or at least it seems that way, that's seems to have put the pin in those negotiations. So now Mueller may not even get to sit down with Trump after all. So already it's kind of feeding back into that larger investigation. And there are other ways that could happen too. I mean, and this is kind of getting a little bit pie in the sky speculative, but, you know, you'll indulge me. It's a Friday,
sure,
I hope.
Sure.
But once you've got all the, so they were looking for evidence specifically in regards to the payments made to Stormy Daniels, of course, and whether that breached, you know, campaign finance rules and so on and so forth. But once they've got evidence, once they've sort of seized the communications between Michael Cohen and Donald Trump, anything else that they catch in there can still be used in the Mueller, like in building a case in the Mueller investigation. So it's kind of, it's ended up being like this backdoor tricky thing in where they might end up with.
Which goes to what he said, right?
Yeah.
Look, I just, butt in. I agree. It is a witch hunt. I mean, they're looking for a silver bullet, and they don't care what the bullet is.
That's you reckon?
That's what it looks like to me. They've got suspicions.
You agree with his crazy tweets?
Oh, look, I agree with one in a thousand of his crazy tweets. But
one in a thousand, but, you know, it's like, an interesting strike rate.
I mean, it's a madhouse over there, but it does seem like they're on a witch hunt, and they're out. They do want to get him, and in the end, if they do get something that can destroy him, or at least terminally damage his credibility. Then, not that he has a lot of credibility, I suppose, in a lot of quarters, but
well, destroy his presidency.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it's big. I agree. It's big stakes.
Yeah, I mean, when you say witch hunt, I mean, you know, as I say, there's, you know, the whole thing with the attorney-client privilege rules is that they surely must have had something, pretty compelling to sign off on those raids.
Not necessarily.
We don't know. We actually don't know.
Yeah, exactly.
Sorry, I love to come back to facts. We actually don't know.
We don't
but
know.
The test is high, you're right.
The test is high That's is all fact. I'm saying. It looks
so,
that way.
Unless they have, you know, decided to mess with the world and the system, they would have had to meet the test. Hey, we've got only a few minutes, so we're going to have to do these because we like the smaller, interesting stories. We're going to start with yours, John Ferguson. A German high-end car manufacturer has recently launched a new luxury ute, and it's got you thinking about the way Australia is changing. Why?
Well, it's interesting. I won't name the brand, but let's just say, am I allowed to name the brand very quickly or not?
Oh, God, you're putting me in a situation now. Just say it just so we know.
Okay. Mercedes-Benz has announced their full line, a new range of utilities, basically. So we're going to have cashed up tradies driving around in Mercedes-Benz utilities.
Fancy.
It is fancy. And I did a little bit of research.
Because you want one?
Well, no, I probably would drive one. I'm from the country. But it's interesting that the Toyota Hilux and the Ford Ranger, I'm sorry, I've mentioned brands again. Forget that.
They were
Australia's best-selling cars of 2017. But now we're going to have Mercedes-Benz in that category. And it just doesn't quite seem the way we were 30 years ago when the Kingswood, and maybe the Kingswood Ute, but you know, you've basically got some very wealthy people out there who, I suppose, are prepared to carry around a wheelbarrow with their cement mixer in the back. I mean, it's quite an astonishing.
It is, you're right, because we've now got the luxury car market in the tradie world. That's really what you're saying.
Yeah, exactly. And
it's an interesting fusion.
Well, it is too. And I think you could also argue that we like to think we were, you know, that Australia was built on the sheep's back, but really we're now one of the most urbanised nations in the world, and we also have this situation where construction is driving our national economy, and so why not have a Mercedes-Benz when you're going around, you know, doing your plumbing job or whatever?
Unless you just want to look like you're a tradie.
There's like, something in that, I
look
think,
at
too.
Me and, yeah. Oh, I wouldn't want to get it dirty. You would, that's the thing, you'd get it dirty, wouldn't you?
I feel like this is going to be so ripe for mockery from every, you know, tradie worth their salt out there is going to think this is the funniest thing.
Oh, look
in
at
the
your
world.
Car, mate.
What self-respecting tradie is getting a luxury ute?
Well, look, let's see how many we see on the roads, I suppose. Now, Ange, your second story, it's a pretty meaty one. You're talking about sort of the art of human progress here. Humans, they're always moving forward. Well, we try to move forward. We like to say we do. Smarter, stronger, faster, with one exception, right?
One exception, particularly for Australian male marathon runners. So everywhere else, we're breaking all these records. The Australian record keeps getting better, faster, stronger, whatever the case may be in the respective event. But with marathons, Rob De Castella is still our record holder. Did
he
you know?
Just so was we really have, good, wasn't he?
We haven't. Well, he was really good, but we've also seen just a general downward trend. Australian male marathon runners are getting slower. And as for why, we've been looking into this week. It's actually the story on today's episode of The Signal, if you're interested in checking out the full version. But basically, there is no one reason. There are a few theories, partly that, you know, 40 years, 30 years down the track, there are more choices of sports. So the talent field is split. There isn't a lot of money in winning marathons. And at the same time, you've had African runners come into the picture who are, you know, the current record holders.
They're so good.
No one can beat them. And so it's a little bit, as an elite sports person, why are you going to pick an event where you've got no hope of being the best in the world? There's like this ceiling there for you. So the best and brightest aren't being or best and fastest, I should say, aren't necessarily being attracted to the sport.
That is actually genuinely really fascinating.
Yeah.
So Aussie males are like, we're not going to do that.
Yeah, I wonder whether it might have a little bit to do with the fact that I know we're talking decades, but the iPad and the iPhones and the kids, I think it's all changing with Australian kids. I think they're less likely to be out there doing
less active
things.
Full stop.
Well, yeah, I think so. I think and the other thing I would want to know either
you get
is,
yours out and get them riding bikes and running.
Yeah, absolutely.
Like I do mine, torturing them.
Mine are like sheepdogs. They just run around until they fall over.
That's
but,
what you do.
I'm not sure that that's the ethos that is more broadly out there in Australia at the moment.
I was very bad at sport.
Interestingly, there is a bit of a tracking, a correlation, if you like, between the decline in our times and then also our broad health as a society. So there is perhaps something to that, you know, our we're basically maybe just a little bit fatter than we were 30 years ago.
I think that's I wasn't going to say that, but
now
I think you're
has.
Right. Now you have. Let's open the floodgates. But I think that's right. I think there's a general... it's the old thing. We talked about the utes and the country and all that sort of stuff. We're very urbanised, more helicopter parenting, you know, less emphasis, I think, on being active.
All right. Well, I'm going to go for a run tonight. You made me feel very bad, both of you. But that is a fascinating story. Hey, thanks, guys, for coming in.
Thanks, PK.